The Top 100 Clubhouse podcast is brought to you by Eden Mill, bringing the tradition of distilling whiskey and gin back to St Andrews, the home of golf. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Top 100 Clubhouse, the ultimate podcast for golf course enthusiasts worldwide. I'm your host, James Henderson, and we're about to embark on a journey through lush fairways and breathtaking landscapes, as well as delving deep into the minds of fascinating individuals from every corner of the golfing universe. Get ready to explore the world's top golf courses through the eyes of those who know them best. This week I sat down with Joshua Ralston, who's a very fascinating gentleman who specializes in Christian-Muslim relations and is actually doing a lot of research on the subject right now. We actually focus more on the Saudi psyche rather than on the actual golf. So for all the nerds on this subject, whether you're a football fan or a golf fan, it's really interesting to hear Joshua talk about it. I hope you enjoy. Hello, Josh. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, do you want to tell the world why you're on the podcast? What's your relevancy?
Yeah, my name's Josh Ralston, and I am a reader at the University of Edinburgh, which is, for your American listeners, something like an associate professor. And I'm a scholar of politics and religion, especially in the Middle East and the Middle East relationship to the West. And so a lot of my work looks at questions of migration, of political discourse about Muslims. I'm also a keen golfer here at North Berwick. And over the last few years, I've gotten more and more interested in Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries' interest in golf. And so I've started to do some research and some writing and some other podcasting about why Saudi Arabia is so interested in golf suddenly.
So why have Saudi Arabia started to invest in sport? What's the reasoning behind it?
Yeah, I think it's complex. A lot of the things that we hear at a lot of other podcasts or popular media is that they're trying to sportswash. Sportswash being the idea that they're investing in golf or in football, soccer for the Americans, to try to improve their image abroad. And I personally don't think that that's their main driver. I think there's much more internal reasons within Saudi society. Saudi Arabia is a very young country. More than 60% are under the age of 30. MBS, or Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is trying to change the society to include much more social interaction, to shift their economy away from oil exclusively. And so sport is one part of doing that. And it bridges that gap. It's both a social enterprise. People can watch football or MMA or golf, but it's also something you can participate in, and it can be an economic driver. So I think those are some of their primary reasons. It may be that down the line it improves their image abroad, but I don't think that's the main reason. I think the main reason is more internal to Saudi society and some of their relationship to other people.
Sports washing is a fairly new term, you're telling me, on the golf course today. It's only been around for 20 years or something.
Yeah, so as scholars or academics, we try to attend to how these terms come to play. Sports has long been used as an instrument of soft power by governments. So think of, for instance, the United States Dream Team, the basketball team in 1992, after the Berlin Wall had fallen, they used sports to try to spread the idea of a sort of America as the new global power. But sports washing as a academic concept or a term really doesn't develop until the 2000s, often by activists, both British and German, to criticize China's involvement in the Olympics or Qatar and the UAE's involvement in football, in buying Man City and PSG. Now, the concept or the practice is longstanding. Most famous examples that people use are the 1936 Olympics in Berlin when Hitler hosts it. But actually, one of the scholars who has researched this thinks that one of the very earliest examples of sports washing was actually the British in using both cricket and rugby in places like what is now India, South Africa, Australia as a way to distract. So the idea of using sports politically as sort of a tool of soft power has been around a long time, but it seems that the term only developed when we're talking about what other people do, not what we do. So yeah. We never sports wash as Americans or Brits or Germans. Only the Arabs or the Chinese or the Russians sports wash. So it might be a helpful term as an activist, but to understand why Saudi's doing it, I'm not sure it's exactly right.
Yeah, Britain used it to great effect in empire, didn't they? To try and, well, it was to introduce almost the rule of law to a lot of these countries that didn't understand our basic principles of court law.
Yeah, and sports is a way to teach rules, to have social distraction, to create community. This has been going on for a long time. As a scholar, for instance, Plato, for instance, even uses gymnastics as a way that people can learn to be good citizens. You use sports. So that's been going on for a long time. Now, when it comes to golf in Saudi Arabia, part of the reason that people focus on the question of sports washing is that Saudi's extreme interest in golf, especially the investments that they've made both in Aramco with the Women's League, with LIV, with the new Open, have come after MBS has been in power, and especially after the global headlines around the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi in 2018 in Turkey. So that's a little bit why a lot of people talk about sports washing. But I think, as I said to you on the golf course, if it is sports washing, it's a really bad business, because no one was talking about Saudi Arabia at the Masters or at the Open Championship before this. But now you have, after Cam Smith wins the Open and in the 150th Open at St. Andrews, people are talking about Saudi Arabia's human rights abuses at the Open. If the goal was to improve your social image, it's sort of an irony that it's done the opposite. Sports has spotlighted human rights abuses, not improve them.
It's kind of backfired on them a wee bit. But the, it's a very good point. If they, Saudis were interest, if the best way to wash cash for them from the oil would be to invest in Apple, invest in all these companies they already do invest in that people don't have an uproar in. Why do you think people are so protective over their own, over sport, over other companies within a country?
Yeah, I think that Saudi oil and now their investment in other, they've made a huge investment, for instance, in Uber. People may have questions about this, but they don't raise the same sort of public ire as sports does, in part because for many people, we think that sports is something that should take us away from politics, take us away from economy, and be something that is either an escape or a place of enjoyment. So the idea that something that we use for entertainment or for leisure or for our own sort of competition, we now have to talk about sports, I think grates on people. I think that's one reason. I think another reason is that the PGA Tour did make decisions, at least its leadership, to reject initial interest from the PIF or the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund and not take their calls, which then reinforced Saudi's idea of investing in what comes to be LIV. And that a lot of the ways that the PGA Tour tried to counter this, especially Jay Monahan, were to paint Saudi in very negative images. So the decision to include 9/11 families, to say you never have to apologize for being a member of the PGA Tour, those sorts of rhetoric, you could say as a cynic, they weren't that committed to the ethics of it. They just saw a threat and thought sports washing would be the best way to challenge this threat. But as we've seen with the decision to possibly take investment from the Sovereign Investment Fund, that wasn't a real ethical commitment because now they've turned and have agreed, or at least tentatively agreed, to explore this. So I think the reasons are both that we think of sports as something that should be free of politics is one. The second is that the PGA Tour and LIV, to a lesser extent, did create a rivalry where you had to choose sides, and they focused on these ethical issues as one of the central reasons that you shouldn't join LIV.
There's going back to a point you made earlier, Aramco, which is essentially the Sovereign Wealth Fund, but in a different company, It's the oil company. They've supported ladies golf for a number of years. Women's golf has been funded by them for a number of years. So why did they decide when it came to the PGA Tour they weren't willing to do the deal, but in the LPGA they were fine with it?
Yeah, I mean, the LPGA Tour as well as the Ladies European Tour do not have the same kind of wealth as the men's tours, especially the PGA Tour. So Aramco's interest in funding women's golf was taken as, here's someone who wants to invest positively. They also found a way to integrate Saudi's interests in changing the sport slightly by including a team component in a way that the PGA Tour seemed not that interested in. So the women's, there was an economic need. There was also more of a willingness by the LPGA and other women's tours to include some changes in the format that the Saudis, or at least the investment fund, were interested in. And that's a stark difference to the decisions that the PGA Tour took or didn't take when the Saudis initially tried to invest in their in sport. Because if you recall, the Saudis first approached the PGA Tour not to create an alternative league, but to explore some possibilities. They were already doing this with what was once called the European Tour. There was always already significant investments in there. And so the interest in women's golf has been quite fascinating, because the growth in women's golf, at least in the purse sizes, has been significantly influenced by Saudi money. Now, of course, the RNA, the USGA, through the Women's Open and the Women's British Open, apologies for forgetting the exact name of what they call the British Open here, has not
the
only
open. We don't need the
British. Open. No, no, but the women's, they have a particular name.
AIG.
AIG, the AIG Women's Open. So the AIG Women's Open, they've upped the purses. They've included going to better courses, more historic courses, Pebble Beach last year, the old course next year. But it's hard to see that the money would have matched without the Saudis sort of pushing them. So we could be cynical and say that they're doing this again for sports washing, and that may be the case. But it's also true that no one has invested as much in women's golf in the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years as the Saudis.
Why not try Eden Mills The Guard Bridge blended malt whiskey or golf gin? Visit our sponsor's site, www.edenmill.com, for more information. Eden Mills St. Andrews, bringing the art of distilling back to St. Andrews. So what I find interesting with following on from that move is we're talking about investment from Gulf states, right? And you've got the Emiratis, who have been funding DP World Tour's £10 million prize purse for years, and Rory McIlroy and the likes, who have been very outspoken against LIV and against Saudi, have been doing these tournaments and competing these tournaments and being proud winners of these tournaments every year. So what's different for someone like Rory within those different countries and different spaces?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've talked about is the challenge of trying to understand a region on its own terms. So Saudi, of course, is the largest, both in geographic size, population, and economically. But its neighbors, both the Emirates, which includes Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and Qatar, have also significant amounts of either natural gas or oil. And they've invested in sports for quite a long time. And the interesting thing about the Emirates is that they historically have been allies with the Saudis. MBS is partly in power because of the head of Abu Dhabi, MBZ, Mohammed bin Zayed. And they have fallen out recently, but they're still allies. And many of the things that Saudis are criticized by Rory and others, authoritarian leader, a war in Yemen, restrictions on the rights of immigrants and migrant workers, are all also factors within the Emirates. Now, there are differences between the Emirates and the Saudis. The Emirates have been much more open to Western styles of entertainment, business than the Saudis, but they both follow a very similar form of Islam. They both have authoritarian leaders. And so there is a little bit of an irony that the the European Tour, now the DP World Tour, is a race to Dubai, a place that, if we are going to be critical ethically of involvement in certain forms of authoritarian capitalism and human rights abuses, the Emirates is guilty of many, many of the same things as the Saudis. And in fact, Roy McIlroy himself talked about the irony after this deal with, or possible deal with, between the PGA Tour and the PIF, where he said, I'm not happy with our decision to take the money, but it seems to be the reality that I'm facing. And I've had to think to myself about the fact that I did live in Dubai for a number of years and that I do have sponsors from Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And maybe some of my ethical critiques, I needed to look a little bit more about decisions I make before. Now, some people might say that's whataboutism, where you're moving away from the ethical issue in front of you by talking about somewhere else. And that could be the case. But for me as a scholar, there's two ways to go about thinking about whataboutism. One is to say, well, the Saudis did it, but what about what China does or the Emirates does or Britain does? That is actually an evasion of the question. It's just saying we all do it. There's another way to do it, which I think is what is more helpful, is to say, well, other people are also doing these. What kind of ethical questions does that raise to us as golf fans or sports fans about the ways that sports is now intertwined with global politics, with questions of ethics that we can't evade? And maybe we should look internally as well about some of the ways in which power, money, and ethical injustices are intertwined with sports.
Yeah. So why golf? I know they've got into football, and obviously football is this massive beast that that's soccer to Americans that is just stupidly large and worldwide, but golf's not. Why? What's the difference for these guys getting involved? Why would they want to get involved in golf and football?
Yeah. For the golf listeners, which I assume is most of us, Saudi has invested more in football than they have in golf. They bought Newcastle United. They've invested billions in their internal league. They've bought four of the Saudi national teams and have bought very famous players like Karim Benzema, N'Golo Kante, Cristiano Ronaldo. So they are also participating in football. But golf is unique. It seems like a strange question of why they would choose golf. There's so many other sports that they could participate in. I personally think in my research that I've seen a few different reasons. One is regional rivalry. Saudi views itself as the big brother, the most powerful one to its neighbors, the Emirates and Qatar. But the Emirates and Qatar have already beat Saudi at football. The Emirates own Manchester City, which is generally considered the best club in the world. They won the Champions League. It's now ubiquitous that Etihad is present at Man City. They can never be the first Arab country to own a Champions League team. Similarly, Qatar has already hosted the World Cup in 2022, the biggest sporting event in the world. Saudi, despite getting the World Cup in 2034, can never be the first. They're always just going to be one player amongst others. And football is a global sport. They could buy a team, they can buy players, but they can never be the main leader at the table. That'll be FIFA, Barcelona, Manchester United, all of these various clubs and leagues. But with golf, they can be a leader. They can be out ahead of Qatar and Emirates. They can not only buy players like Brooks Koepka or John Rahm on the men's side, or a series of women's events like the Aramco Team Series. They can, it seems, be either the biggest player or one of the biggest players in the entire sport. So why buy a club when you can buy an entire sport? Now, they won't necessarily have the same power as the USGA or RNA or maybe even the PGA Tour, but they've bought themselves a seat at the table where they are one of the most important ones. So I think there's that element. There's also an internal one where MBS is trying to change the economy and society, building new cities, changing the culture.
It seems like he's the main reason, when he came to power, is the reason they started following that more Dubai and Qatar, well, concerted effort to westernize almost.
Yeah.
But why did the previous leadership not look towards these places and see success?
So they did see some success, but Saudi is a country with a deep history and tradition. And what's important to understand is that MBS would be the first king who is not a son of the founder of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud, who founded Saudi Arabia in the year 1932, every single king has been one of his sons. You might think, how is that possible? Well, he had over 100 children from 22 different wives, so he had sons of many generations. But this last generation is dying off, and there's a tussle of who is going to take power. And so for MBS, you know, previous kings have been in their late 70s or early 80s. MBS is in his 30s. So it represents not only an age shift, but a generational shift.
How has he come to power then if there's that many children kicking around?
So his father is one of the last of the original sons. And he came to power in the year 2015 at the age of 78 or 79, Salman, hence Mohammed bin Salman. And his son, MBS, was put in charge of the economy in 2015. And over a few years, was able to exert a number of points of pressure and power to essentially become the de facto ruler. Part of that is a sea change of people wanting younger power. Some of it was extremely ruthless. So MBS, for instance, imprisoned a number of major Saudi businessmen, other crown princes in the Ritz-Carlton, and forced them to essentially give a fair amount of their money back to him. So all of the things about sports washing are largely true. He is an authoritarian leader. If you're critical of him on Twitter or in public, you will be prosecuted or arrested. Those are all true. But so he used a mix of charisma, youth, social media to gain this kind of power. And part of it is this vision, the Saudi 2030 vision, which includes creating new cities. And this is where golf comes back in. Because especially for many upwardly mobile Saudis who have been educated in the West, golf is often seen of as a sport that you can play throughout your life. It's often thought of as an upper class sport. If you have a home on a golf course, even if you're not a golfer, this appeals to you. So the decision to invest in golf, which includes building courses in these new cities, is part of this sort of vision of a new Saudi Arabia, one that isn't just what it was since 1932 or earlier, but is looking outward to engagements with cinema, concerts, golf courses, football, F1, et cetera. And golf is just one small part of this.
But yet it's rocking the whole world.
It's having huge impact on the golf world. It has, for the last 2 years, been the dominant discussion in the golf world. You have, for instance, the rollback, which initially is getting all of this discussion on social media, on podcasts, in writing. But then Jon Rahm's decision to take the money and to join LIV suddenly washed out the rollback. The most important question now became Jon Rahm. What is the PGA Tour going to look like? Is there LIV going forward? And so the Saudis, they've bought themselves a seat at the table. I mean, some people think, and you'll hear this quite a lot, whether in the Alan Shipnook book or sometimes on other podcasts, that this is about Yasser Al-Rumayyan's desire to play at Augusta or be a member of Shinnecock. You know, he loves golf. I'm sure as the head of the Sovereign Wealth Fund, they wouldn't be this interested in golf if it wasn't for him. But it seems a little bit simplistic that a country of that size would spend that much money just to appease the interests of one guy to join this. So instead, it's really about their interest in being global players, their interest in being better than their regional neighbors, and their interest in changing their own internal politics. I think it's all three of those.
They're building a huge number of golf courses in Saudi Arabia. And I know that a couple of the contracts in LIV I've heard do involve design aspects. I don't know if you know more about it than I do.
Yeah, so a number of these do involve building new courses, both in around Riyadh as well as around Jeddah. Jeddah's on the west coast near the Red Sea. Riyadh's on the east on a high plateau. And in fact, recently I was flying to the United States in November for an academic conference on religion in Texas. And the guy who was sitting next to me saw that I was reading the LIV book by Shipnook as well as some other documents. And he asked me what I thought about it. And here you are stuck for 9 more hours on a plane. Do you really want to talk about golf in Saudi Arabia? But you could tell he was a golfer. He had that American golfer look about him. And turns out he was flying back from Riyadh, where he had just signed a contract with Golf Saudi because he is the biggest provider of seed and turf in the world. And so he provided all of the turf, for instance, for the World Cup in Qatar. And so we ended up talking. The irony is that we're sitting next to each other. I was also wondering why he wasn't in business class, but that's neither here nor there. And he said that Saudi Arabia is by far their biggest growth market in the world, followed next by Vietnam, and that they have a huge interest in building dozens and dozens of course, providing, and he would be providing the seed and the turf from his company center in the American Southeast. And so this idea, the PGA Tour, the LPGA, the various ladies tournaments, this is part of it, but it's part of a broader ecosystem of trying to build up golf also in Saudi. And not just golf, but sports more generally. There's been since MBS has come to power, there's been something like a 123% increase in Saudi's participation in sports, gymnastics, track and field, football, golf, which also adds to issues in their society around not being active enough in obesity. So golf is one factor in this broader arena.
How about in the country? What are women allowed to play the sports, or are they?
Yeah, so Saudi is a difficult place to be a scholar of because it's changed recently, but women, since MBS has been in power, are now allowed to drive. They're allowed to attend football matches. They're allowed to attend sporting events, but there still are certain rules around women's, especially non-married women's freedom of movement. But it does seem that they're aiming to include and grow women's golf. And part of this is that if you have a society that still wants to value, I wouldn't say the separation of men and women, although that also happens there, but certain traditional values around separating men's and women's, not touching, for instance, golf is a sport that allows that in a much more easy way than, say, football or other sports.
It's because it's not just happened with them supporting women's golf. They supported, they made Newcastle United's female team, which is in the third division of ladies football, the most attended team in women's football in England, which is massive.
Yeah.
I don't know why there's a, it's a bit of an oxymoron. It's a bit of a.
Yeah. I mean, this is one area that's difficult to understand. And I think it would be helpful to do more research on this because Saudi Arabia does have a very rigid interpretation of Islam that most other Muslim countries do not agree with, the separation of men and women in public spaces. And so the fact that you have this very strict interpretation that's been existing for a few hundred years, coupled with a investment in women's sports, it could be, you know, that they're just trying to sports wash, that they're trying to say, hey, we may treat women and invest in women's sports in the UK or the United States, or even in Saudi Arabia, if you come here as a non-Saudi, but we don't allow that same thing for women within our country. But I sometimes think that we have a little bit of a simplistic understanding of what goes on in Saudi, the ways that women are educated. For instance, I've had, in fact, in my classes at the University of Edinburgh, I've had women Saudi students who are doing undergraduate degrees here. I've had both a Bin Laden, which is a famous family, not just from Osama, but they're one of the most wealthy families in all of Saudi Arabia, a major construction company. I've had one of their children. I've had a Ibn Saud, like a Al Saud family student, a princess in my class. So you have Saudi women who are being educated in Edinburgh and New York and London and other places. So that isn't to deny that there isn't inequality, and there has been longstanding Saudi feminist activism, but it is interesting that they've decided to leverage it this way. It could be a genuine interest. It could also be sports washing. My tendency is to be more both and, that people are more complex than we realize.
Do you think that having sports within, say, England or the US with golf, will westernize the views of people within Saudi who watch these sports?
I mean, Saudis, like any people, are more complex than we give them credit for. And there's a tendency, and this is one of the things that got me to start writing about this, is there's a tendency to speak about Saudi Arabia as monolithic, that all Arabs, all Muslims are the same. And there's many Saudis that are pious Muslims, but also attend Western sporting events or are educated in the West, who want their children, for instance, there might be men that want their daughters to be educated. So it's not this rigid image that we often have. And many Saudis, especially wealthier Saudis, already exist between Saudi and the West. Many of them have homes in London. Many of them are educated in Edinburgh or St. Andrews or Princeton. And so they're already used to operating in both these ways. Think, for instance, in Edinburgh in the summer, there are dozens and dozens of families from Qatar, Emirates, and Saudi who holiday here. So many of these people are already living in these two different ways. Now, in fact, one of the things MBS did, and I'm not trying to make him out to be this hero, I'm very critical of a lot of his authoritarian actions, but one of the things he realized is you already had Saudis following football and sport on TV, on illegal streams, on Twitter. Why not bring that out in the open and let them follow their clubs nearby? It would be more financially beneficial for us for them to attend a game in Riyadh or Jeddah than them to watch an illegal stream of Juventus. And so some of it is an honest recognition that Saudis already exist as global citizens. And some of it is that there is a desire, I think, to recognize the ways in which Saudis both want to maintain certain historic values of their cultures, and again, their cultures are different, but also be honest that some of that involves engagement with these things. So to give you an example, Saudis often go to the Emirates to shop. So one of the things MBS is saying, why have them go to Dubai? Why not have them stay in Riyadh? There's economic reasons for this. Let's be honest. Let's call a spade a spade. And so sport is, again, one part of this broader thing. I think one of the things that's bothered me as a scholar in the discourse about golf and Saudi is either you have to think Saudi is just this nefarious actor that is totally unique. They're spending billions of dollars recklessly to improve their image or because they hate America. Or you have this Saudi are the best thing that's ever happened to golf. They're disrupting the game. Let's just ignore all the human rights abuses. And there's a lot of area between those two.
A lot of nuances.
Yeah, a lot of nuances. You can say they both have sincere reasons internally and their government is trying to distract you from its own actions. One of the other things to say is that we seem to be holding sports to a standard that we're not willing to hold politicians and business people to.
Yeah.
So John Rahm, for instance, is getting the kind of criticism, or Phil Mickelson, I think those are slightly different cases, that American politicians, the Prime Minister of Britain, CEOs of Fortune 100 companies are not getting. All of those people are already taking as much, if not more, money from the Saudis. They had the political clout to try to stand up to MBS after the assassination and chose not to. So why is it that we seem to be asking sports figures more than we're asking politicians or business people when it comes to ethically to Saudi?
On that topic of politicians, what's going on with Liv and PGA right now? It seems like the government in the US are trying to do a bit of jiggery-pokery to stop it to happen.
Yeah, so it seemed to be that the American laws about monopolies was coming into play with the idea of the merger. Now, the merger itself, it appears, was in partly done, or the agreement was partly done because the Saudis didn't want to be deposed and the PGA Tour didn't have the money to compete.
Yeah.
So they both had a reason to come to the table. We don't want to be deposed in American court. We can't keep funding $20, $25 million purses. And so the idea of the agreement was partly to squash these lawsuits. But if you have an agreement to squash lawsuits, then the Department of Justice says, is this really an agreement or is this a cover-up? And so it seems that part of what's going on, and it's difficult to know, the rumors keep coming out, is that the interest in having a third investor, so this possible new sports investor, would be to appease the Department of Justice. Because if the PIF is giving money, this new sports investor is giving money, and the PGA Tour is involved, then it's less likely to be seen as simply doing this. But it's unclear whether or not this is illegal or not, or if this is rather U.S. interest in trying to keep Saudi out of a significant American sport. Now, obviously, golf is a global sport, but the PGA Tour has become an American sport, which is one of the criticisms that's levied against it. In part, I think one of the interesting things about LIV is the amount of non-American players that have joined. So you've got the South American contingent, you've got the British, you've got the Aussies, you've got a number of, a few Japanese players. And so there is a sense in which the PGA Tour's American-centricness is also at play.
The money's always been in America, though.
Yeah, of course. You can't put up the kind of event at Royal Melbourne financially. It would be great to have a tournament at Royal Melbourne, but the Aussies can't afford the purses that you're going to have at the Wells Fargo, although Wells Fargo's now dropping out because they don't want to pay $25 million. They're only willing to go up to $20 million, or even what can happen here in the European Tour. So even the Rolex events, they're not nearly what the U.S. ones are. So the U.S. does have the market. It does have the money. It does have the businesses. It does have the TV deals. So there is a reason there. But if the Saudis are willing to invest billions of dollars, then that could change the dynamics. I still think it'll be U.S.-centric, but it could include, you know, a Spanish swing or a golf swing, include Jeddah, these things in the summer.
It'd be cool to have a Scottish and English, get some of the top courses in Scotland and England on it as well.
Yeah, Ireland.
Ireland's so underappreciated.
Yeah.
I'm excited for RCD coming up next year, the Irish Open, but the golf courses in Ireland that are just never seen on TV.
No, and the fact that the Irish Open's now gone to inland courses rather than to, has only hurt it, and the Scottish Open kind of growing in being the lead up to the Open has hurt the Irish, although now it's shifting its time.
The Scottish has done well.
Yeah.
Done very well. Renaissance has gone from strength to strength. So what do you think's next then? What do you think's going to happen to LIV and PGA?
I think that any golf fan needs to come to grips with the fact that Saudi's interest in golf is not going away. And if we have ethical criticisms of the Saudis, which I do with many other people do, we need to think about what those are and how we're going to relate to them, and not just continue with the same sort of tropes. A lot of time, anytime the Saudis are mentioned, I see a lot of journalists, what can only be described as anti-Arab stereotypes. You know, these rich sheikhs, these silly people, they don't know what they're doing, or they're medieval. So I would love for golfers to try to learn a little bit more about Saudi and to avoid those. But when it comes to what's going to happen, the Saudis are going to continue to be interested in golf. They haven't spent these billions of dollars to now walk away. It is up in the air of what's going to come next. Are they going to find a way to merge? That could still include a live component, right? A summer or winter swing in warmer climates, you know, Australia in the Northern Hemisphere's winter. Is that going to be something like the ladies have done with these team series? Or are they going to continue to be rivals and they're going to be opposite leagues? Which I think if that's the case, all it's going to do is increase the importance of the majors. Because for even non-casual golf fans, so even ardent golf fans of the men's game, it's increasingly rare to care beyond the four majors, maybe the Ryder Cup, and a few other events like, let's say, Riviera or Wentworth. And it's really uncertain whether or not the amount of egos, the amount of players' involvement in the PGA Tour is going to allow there to be a reconciliation, especially given the fact that a number of the players that stayed seem to want recompense for that, some sort of financial payout. That said, the decision of John Rahm to take whatever it is, 400, 600 million, we don't know.
It's more than the purchase of Newcastle. I'll give you that.
It is more than the purchase of Newcastle. It would seem to demand that the PGA Tour takes the Saudis much more seriously. If you can get one of the top two, three, four players in the world, depending on how you rank him, if you can then take one of the major European players, so much so that Rory's saying, we've got to redo the rule because Rom has to be at the Ryder Cup or we're not going to have a chance. I think that's partly a decision by LIV, but even more by the Saudi Investment Fund to say, if you're going to keep dallying, we're willing to keep going. And whether that leads to a number of other players that have been mentioned joining him, or whether this is the moment that the PGA Tour says, we've got to do a deal with PIF, because if we don't, then LIV's not going away. So I think the next few months are going to be make or break for the future of men's golf.
Why did LIV always go towards the PGA and not think? Did they ever try to do anything with the DP World Tour?
So, according to a number of reporting, Alan Shipnook's book "Live and Let Die," they did try to approach the European Tour and the DP World Tour, partly because of the rivalry between the DP World Tour and DP and Saudi. There was difficulties around this, and the PGL was also percolating around this idea. So there was already an interest in reframing golf to make something like a global tour. Obviously, there's now been all of these comparisons to F1, partly from Netflix, but the idea of an F1-style global tour appealed to both PGL, DP World Tour, and to the Saudis. But the Saudis weren't able to make the kind of inroads within the European Tour that they thought. I think also, I don't know if I mentioned this already, I know I did on the golf course when we were talking to Kyle, but golf, especially in the U.S., is the only sport that I can think of that allows golfers and funders to rub shoulders with some of the biggest businessmen and women in the world. You've got these pro-ams, you've got these sponsors, whether it's AT&T, Wells Fargo, the Genesis, Rolex, and golf gives Saudi access to not just golfers, but also to major business people. And so the U.S., as we said earlier, is where that happens first and foremost.
Yeah.
And so they always were going to be interested in the U.S. You can even see, like, they were making this argument that LIV was going to be a global tour, and it has been. I mean, they went to Adelaide, which was clearly their most successful event. They've gone to Spain, they've gone to Singapore, but they still have a large number of events in the U.S. because they realize that the U.S. is still the biggest consumer of sports in the world.
Right, okay. This is a question that might be irrelevant because you might have already answered it, but what's the worst and best argument you've heard for LIV merging with the PGA?
Well, I think the best argument is its inevitability, that the Saudis simply have too much money and too much willpower that they're going to wear you down. And if they do wear you down, then it brings back together the best men's players in the world. And I would rather watch Cam Smith and John Rahm play against
Rory and
Scheffler and Ludwig than not. And if they're going to continue to poach young players, and who knows who's next, that significantly dilutes every event other than the majors. So the best is that actually, once you realize the Saudis aren't going away, you then either have to make a decision. I want to make an ethical stand and not do business with the Saudis. But if you make that ethical stand, then you need to start making a lot of other ethical stands. And then you have to ask questions about pro sports in general. And maybe we should just not be spending our time playing pro sports, and we should go back to playing a match at North Berwick or our local course, yeah. Right? But once you say, no, sports is a big business, the Saudis want to be involved, and they have the kind of capital that no one can compete with, we're at the logical endpoint, because they could outweigh, unless huge amounts of business want to say no and invest alternatively. So that, to me, seems to be the major reason. The weakest, I'm not sure what, you know, I am a little bit of an idealist. I'm an academic. We live in our heads. But at some point, you also have to be realistic and make your peace with the world as it is. And we may want to change that. But the kind of changes that would be needed in our world to mean that countries that oppress their people or extradite people and be murdered aren't involved in capitalism. That's not the way the world worked. Yeah. I mean, we thought in the 1990s that economic freedom and liberalism would come with political liberalism. It turns out it's been the opposite, that the most successful capitalist countries recently, China, Russia, Saudi, the Emirates, are authoritarian. And that we've got to think more broadly about that.
Right. Okay. We always finish on one thing. You ready?
Go for it.
Top five favorite golf courses.
Top five favorite golf courses. Well, we just played a round at North Berwick, where I've been a member by the absolute luck of the gods for the last 6 years. I'm not going to include that, even though it clearly would be one of the six, just because I've played it maybe 1,000 times. The top six, I mean, top five, so we'll include North Berwick. Muirfield, I've only played it once. When I came over, I thought it would be my favorite course, and then I heard everything about it, and I thought, oh, it must be overrated. And I played it last year, and I was just blown away with it. I thought the routing was fantastic, the variety of holes, the green complexes, the way it made you think. It was the first time that I really understood the brilliance of the routing. And so Muirfield, that would be one. Another one that came to mind is Yale. I played Yale when I was over at Yale giving a lecture in 2019, and I asked the person was hosting me, if you're a professor, you can get somebody on. So I played Yale. It was my first Rainer McDonald. It was in rough shape. Like, it's not in good condition. I know they're renovating it or restoring it with Hans, but it was my first template course, and it was a great day. The land movement was amazing. The variety of the ways that you saw these template holes, which I had mostly experienced here in the UK, unlike most of their Americans who experienced them at other template courses. So I loved Yale. I had a fun time. I can't wait to see what they are going to do with it.
Yeah, it's very exciting. He's probably the number one renovator in the world alive.
Yeah. And you could just see the potential on the course, but it was in very rough shape. And then I know it went to pot after COVID, so it's even more. But the land movement, the varieties of the ways that he's done the templates, Redan here is still better than Redan there. So Yale would be another one that came to mind. I really enjoyed Sunningdale. I played all 36 in one day. I have a hard time thinking how...
How many solstices do you have?
I had one both times, so twice. The second time I played old first and new second, and the second time at new... We just let like three or four people go while we were eating our sausages and drinking a beer. My favorite holes were actually on the new, not on the old, but the old was a better sum of its parts. But I thought five and six on the new were fantastic.
Well, it's interesting because you can ask a top high-end golf rater and you can still have the conversation if they prefer the new or old.
Yeah.
That's the level of quality these two courses are at.
And I think if it wasn't for the first and the 18th at the new, I could be convinced. But so I'm going to count that as one because it was all in one day.
Yeah. It's probably the best 36-hole complex in UK golf.
Yeah, it's probably one of the best 36 complex in the whole world that isn't a resort. I'll test that out hopefully next month at Royal Melbourne.
There's a serious.
There we go. So I'm going to Australia in a couple of weeks. So I'll probably change my list soon. But so Muirfield, Yale, Sunningdale, Royal Lytham. I played last summer, and you'll get a trend here where I like courses that there's not a single standout, but the just rooting and the sum is better than its parts. I found Lytham a really fair test of golf. I mean, it's the bunkers are challenging. I was able to avoid any until the seventh. the area around the turn, the finish, the closing hole, the way that the bunkers are hidden. I really liked Lytham, and I would say My final one would be Royal Aberdeen came to mind. Again, probably just the front nine. The back nine lets you down a little bit, but the highs of the front nine are so good. And I think, I don't think enough people talk about it. I think it should be...
It's been forgotten about.
Yeah. I think because, you know, you got your Cruden Bay, maybe Trump Aberdeen, Merker, but it's not like right on the list where you can hop over to Panmure or Carnoustie from Fife.
I don't think it helps that it's quite tight golf course. It's quite a tight driving golf course.
Yeah.
And that's instantly not cool right now.
No. Yeah. No, it's got... And you got to drive through the dunes... the last time I played it was in the open there, and I was on a heater playing great around the turn. I thought I hit a great shot on 10, but it's this blind sort of huge dog leg left and didn't draw enough, and next thing you know, you got a double. but I find it a really interesting course. I think it's unique to Scotland. I mean, I love Scottish courses. I like a lot, you know, with Muirfield or other places that are a little more subtle, but I think it's kind of the drama of Royal Aberdeen comparatively. And I like to be a little bit different.
More Irish dunes.
Yeah, more Irish dunes.
There's, so, like Macrahanish is a bit like that, where next thing you know it, you're staring up at a wall of dunes and you're like, oh God, how am I meant to get over this?
Yeah, and the, I mean, the second, you know, in my eclectic 18, I always go back and forth. But at the moment, I have the first at Royal Aberdeen as my first hole, just because I don't think there's that many great firsts. But I think it's a fun little challenge. But then the second in playing this long par five in between the dunes that they've pushed back, and if you block it a little bit right, you've got to carry a 50 or 60 yard dune, foot dune, which reminds me of one of my favorite holes in golf, which is the sixth at St. Enedoc. So yeah, those would be the five that came to my mind today. If you asked me tomorrow, I'd probably change my mind. So,
well, thank you very much for coming on. That was really good fun.
Great, thanks.
I think you can all agree that was fascinating listening to Joshua talk about Saudi. If you want to be in contact, james@top100golfcourses.com or get me on the Instagram, @officialtop100. This is our last pod before Christmas. So Merry Christmas. Enjoy it. I hope you're getting all the golf goodies that you want. And please remember, play fast, launch slow.